It is fantastic to be here and to think about the time when in David and Amanda's home, there were about five people sitting around the table. And that was this group. And it's been steadily growing, and I just want to say I'm really proud of the work here. Excited to see at least half of you I don't know, which is kind of cool. And so next year, maybe that could happen again, but we won't be able to meet here, I'm sure. So that'll be a good problem, right? Do you know what happened on 495 years ago on this day? October the 31st, 1517. In another country. You go, I'm not in school. This is the evening. What are you doing to me? Somebody nailed 95 theses on the door of the Wittenberg church building. It probably wasn't Martin Luther. That wasn't said about him until after he died. He never took credit for it. We think what happened is one of his scribes did it, and he got really excited and ran ahead, and there you go. up until about the 16th century, the 1500s, there was a view of God and as an interface, the view of God interface with the way that we live. And if you have a pencil and paper, you can do this, but if you don't, that's okay. You could draw a circle, and then you draw a small circle in the middle. The small circle in the middle would have God and religion, or God and church. And then you could have six puzzle pieces around that small circle. And in those puzzle pieces, you could put the name arts, reason, recreation, family, civil authorities, things like that. Up and through the Reformation era, God was in the middle, and your spiritual life was in the middle. And so everything you did, God was permeated through it. Mm-hmm. And so the laws were based on knowledge of God. People worshiped God through their arts. Many beautiful things were made in eras like that. Great buildings, great paintings, great works of sculpture. And there's a lot of good that came out of that view that God is the center. Now, it got abused from time to time because, of course, man wants to equate his power and rule of authority over the church and make that connected to God. But, however, there was some real good in that where God is the center. As a matter of fact, that is the view of the Bible. In the Hebrew Bible, all the way through Christian times, through the Dark Ages, one thing was at least right. God is the most important thing, and God helps us navigate all those other areas. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. In the 1700s, something happened. 1600s, 1700s, we entered into the Enlightenment. What replaced God and church and religion in the middle? Close. What else? Reason, yes. Okay, what's the downside of that? You can't know everything. What else? Our ways are not God's ways. Okay, yes.
You need to see to believe.
Okay, absolutely. That was a big one. Yes. Okay, right. So we're so reason based that we lose the concept of grace. You know, the other downside that happened about with all this is that one of those puzzle pieces became God, or God in religion, or God in church. So, what's the downside of that? What's the big C word? We begin to compartmentalize. And so, I've got room for God, I've got room for arts, I've got room for civil authorities, I've got room for recreation. I've got room for all these things, but then, oh God, oh yeah, God, I got room for God too. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, now, let's add up the amount of time that a disciple in the Central London ministry puts in the strictest God things, okay? Church on Sunday, how many hours is that?
Okay.
Okay, just the three. Okay, how about midweek? What do we have here?
Two.
Okay, so we're up to five. All the average amount of discipling hours that you have, whether you're discipling somebody or somebody's discipling you or whatever, what do you think that is in a given week?
Four.
Okay, let's say it's four. Now we're up to nine, okay? So now add sharing your faith and works, like doing something for hope or whatever. What would that? Okay, all right, let's go to 11. Okay, anything else? Okay, how about quiet time in the morning? Okay, we're just going to give an hour. We're just going to be generous, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, okay. So we're up to 18, okay? Okay, so on top, now what's after that?
Family group.
Family group, okay. So what is that, 2 hours a week?
Three.
Okay, so we're 21. Okay, anything else? Okay, how many hours are there in a week? Okay. We all sleep different amounts, but let's just suffice to say that's a small percentage of our week, right? And there's a potential that we can compartmentalize and say that's our God stuff. Okay. And what is the dangers of doing that? Okay, we don't think about God the rest of the time. Now imagine. First of all, how many of you live in a dorm kind of configuration? Raise your hand. Okay, only about four. Pardon me? We kind of do, yeah. okay, so the rest, do only four people in here live in a dorm? Okay, is it tempting in the dorm to do non-Christian kind of things?
Yes.
Yeah. Jokes, right?
Yeah.
Humor. Revelry. And then so on and so forth, right? Okay. It's really good to think of living in a dorm as part of your God time. Because it'll change everything. Wouldn't it? Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about getting our center centered. And we're going to be reading out of Luke chapter 10. We're going to study the story that we typically call the parable of the Good Samaritan. We're going to look at the subject of the story as an example for us, kind of a viewfinder of how we could live. And so there's this really fascinating story here in Luke chapter 10, verse 25. By the way, this whole subject is kind of the idea of being a holistic Christian. Okay. Yes, what was your question? Yes, you can record me, yeah. I'm being recorded already, but you can, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So this whole thing is under the idea of being a holistic Christian. And does anybody here want to take a gander at what holistic means? Yes.
Holistic kind of encompasses everything, but also kind of ad hoc as on the go as you go.
Okay. Sure. Encompassing everything, yes.
Isn't it like your whole being, so like your well-being, your physical being?
Your right. The whole essence of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we're going to look at the parable of the Good Samaritan as, like I said, a viewfinder for how we might live in verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Not a real good idea, by the way. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? He replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this, and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself. So he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Now this is the first step of compartmentalizing. You know, he could have just launched away from this discussion and just gone on out there and obeyed the good commandments, you know, the greatest commandments here, and changed the world, been satisfied, been aligned by a great rabbi, you know, being sorted out. Oh yeah, this is what I'm going to do. But there's just this thing in us. We want to know what is the bare minimum requirement. You know, what can I get by with? And one of the things that people have tried to get by with ever since the Reformation in 1517 is I want to just get by with faith. Faith alone. And so that's only two words, right? Faith alone. Can you remember that? Okay. A lot of people remember that really, really well. There's about three or four Bible verses that say, that really emphasize faith. But only one says faith alone. Do you know where that's at? Those of you with your little electronic devices would be able to search and find out that it's only in James chapter, I believe, 2, where faith alone is viewed in a negative context. Even the devil has faith. He believes. But it must produce something else. So we've been in a minimalist kind of a world ever since at least the Reformation. The devil's been that way all along, looking for the way to just get by, to eke out. So anyway, in reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. When he fell into the hands of robbers, they stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road. And when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, took pity on him. He went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said. "And when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expenses you may have." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." Jesus was being tested, but Jesus set him up because there was only one right answer. And by saying the right answer, he was in a predicament, right? It's like, uh-oh, I met my match, or I've lost this match. This parable is very, very powerful. There's a story in American history from the 1960s. I believe the year is 1967. In New York, where a woman, Kitty Genesevi, was for over 40 minutes being beat up, raped, and was killed. And she called out over and over again, screaming. She was attacked as she entered the complex where she lived, fought and drug all throughout the complex, all the way up to her apartment. And then finally the police arrived, and over the next days, they interviewed all the people living there, and they found 38 people who heard her screaming and did nothing, including not even calling the police. And so it was a life changer for the city of New York, because New York was a very religious city, very Roman Catholic, about 2/3 Roman Catholic. And some of these people were churchgoers. And so something had happened. There was an organization that started as a result of this, the death of Kitty, called the Bad Samaritan Society, to figure out what was the phenomena that good New Yorkers, normally good, not in a bad neighborhood, not seedy people, didn't do the right thing, even without risking their own life to place a phone call. Why didn't they do the right thing? And so this parable here was evoked to raise questions. And if you talk to a New Yorker who's been around a long time, they all know the story. This was the beginning of a soul search. And I hope tonight, Chicagoan will be able to help you soul search. How you respond, you know, 24/7, you know, how we function out there. So are you ready for the challenge?
Yes.
Okay, good. I know you are. You guys are great people. Yeah, I know you are. What we're going to do is look at all four areas that Jesus said were to love. And so we're really not trying to love 24/7. We're trying to love 24/7 in four ways. Always making sure we're mindful of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. Because if you're an intellectual and you just love exclusively with your mind, you can spend a lot of time in a library. A lot of time in front of a Bible, in a concordance, multiple versions. Learn Hebrew, learn Greek, learn geography, go to the Holy Land, dig up bones and rocks and tablets, and make it all make sense, right? And still miss everything if you don't do the other things, okay? Okay, let's talk about the way that the Samaritan engaged with his heart. But before we do that, I would like to read some quotes, just to talk about heart for a second. An early Christian named Cyprian said, "Mankind should learn to love the things that are dear to God." Clement of Alexandria, a North African teacher, he said, "When a person knows God, his whole life is a prayer and a conversation with God." Mm-hmm. And then Clement also said, "The one who knows God will most likely and gladly depart from this life out of his love for the Lord. Perhaps he will even thank the one who executed him and the one who laid the plot against him." Mm-hmm. Justin Martyr. His name wasn't really Justin Martyr. It was Justin. He was martyred. "The teachings have transformed our lives. Many of us used to hate and destroy one another. We would not live with people of a different race because of their different customs. But now, since the coming of Christ, we live closely with such people and we pray for our enemies." Loving with our hearts, as the Samaritan did. Now let's talk about the three players besides the person who was hurt by the robbers. What is a Levite? Okay.
It was just like it was a clan separate from all the others.
From the other people of Israel. Yeah. It was one of the 12 tribes distinguished for a specific kind of service. Okay.
Priesthood.
Okay. The priests had to come out of the Levites, but not all Levites were priests. Mm-hmm. And so, but that out of that, you know, separated group, it had some more regulations than the rest of the Israelites. Came the priest. But so this separated group were people that ought to know better.
Yeah.
They out of them would come the teachers of the law, people that were scribes, did a lot of activities around the temple, and then there would be designated priests. So we have a priest as well in this story. So what is a priest? What's that?
People that serve specifically inside the temple.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Served inside the temple. And there's a lot of important details to some of the tasks that they had.
Yeah.
The kind that you just don't mess up. A lot of risk would be involved. And so we had a segment, let's just say for argument's sake, that a 12th of all the people of Israel, special, highly trained, that was a Levite. We had one of those people in this story. And then we have somebody who's from within that group, higher expectations, in a leadership role. We have a priest. So we have a leader and a special person, kind of the cream of the crop group for service among Israel. So Jesus is using in his parable, he's making up a fake story that doesn't reflect good on a leader kind of role in the special select group of the people of Israel. Okay, wow. Now, what do we know about the Samaritans? Yes?
They were mixed race, right?
They're mixed race, but much more than that. What else? They're mixed with Assyrian blood, by the way.
And
that's for the racial part.
The Jews?
Pardon me?
The Jews didn't really like them, and the Samaritans didn't like the Jews.
Right. What happened when King Solomon had his son, Rehoboam, was a real bad son, rebelled, and one of his buddies, in a real messy ordeal, split Israel into the northern and southern kingdom, or Israel and Judah. It's kind of, that's kind of the bottom line way to say it. There's a lot of details in there. So about 10.5 tribes, 10 or 11 depending on how you count it, were north, and they went with the Assyrians, mixed blood, mixed religion, shared a lot of the same strange and very illicit practices. Israel, every single king in the Old Testament was bad, and they landed in such a place that when they had their last king, that was Samaria, is where all the residents were. And so they kind of had half of the customs of Israel. We call them half Jews. But they were really worldly and pagan as well. And they filtered parts of what we call the Old Testament and rejected them. But they kept certain things in place. And Jacob's well happened to be in Jerusalem. So they said, hey, we had Jacob's well. We're really holy here, you know. And so they thought they were special. So they were antagonistic against the Jews. Matter of fact, there was hills in Samaria that they used to set up fires on the hills. Now, hills in Israel were used to signal holy days or to signal we have a war or something like that, you know, like Morse code with fire. And the Samaritans would start fires on their hills just to throw all the rest of the Jews off and confuse them. So they're very antagonistic. These are not friends of the Jews, okay? So you have a Levite and a priest who is a Levite too, not looking good in this parable. And then a Samaritan who's a half-Jew, pagan customs, mixed race, all that kind of stuff, and he's the good guy in the parable. What do you think Jesus is doing?
He's trying to shock them.
Okay, he's trying to shock them. Okay, good. Yes, Ben?
I was trying to say it's not about kind of where you're from or what you claim to be. It's,
okay.
It's more than that.
It's more than the color of your skin and your family of origin. Mm-hmm. You can't take claim on those external things. And you're being, he's shocking them. I mean, this is something to think about here. Do you think today if Jesus were here and he was telling a parable, he might do a parable of the good Muslim or something?
Yeah.
Okay? For the church, for Christianity. Who knows what segment he might use. My even saying that is a kind of a, well, I don't know, Steve, what makes you say that? Well, right, you have to say that, you know? I don't know what he would use, but I think he would shock us, you know? Okay? So that these are the players here that he's using. Okay, now, how, in this story, as you look at your text, did the Samaritan demonstrate an engagement with his heart and his emotions? How did he do that? Yes.
The way he took care of him.
Okay. Okay, David?
He had pity on him.
He had pity on him. Right, he had pity on him. Yes.
I think he was contrasting the initial question.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. And we'll, as we analyze this more, let's now look to see how we love God with your soul. Another quote here, rather than laying down our souls for money, we ought to lay down our money for souls, Tertullian. Irenaeus, the business of a Christian is nothing else than the preparing for death. Okay, we think of soul and eternity, you know. Anyway, I've got a lot of these kind of quotes. How do you think the Samaritan put his soul into his actions? Yes?
By, in a sense, thinking as probably went like above and beyond what was necessary.
Right.
So he looked at the bigger picture, not just let me help him and get him somewhere safe, but let me help him bandage his wounds, take him to an inn, pay him overnight, come back, pay any additional expenses.
Right.
In reference to the fact that he sincerely cared.
Right. And both of you are right. I think both those comments relate to the soul. Have you ever seen those stories or read a book about somebody making a bargain with the devil? And it's usually a trade for your soul for wealth and riches. Mm-hmm. And so there's often a comparison and contrast about the riches, 1 Timothy chapter 6, versus the eternal things. Mm-hmm. And so, especially in a Western context, in a materialistic world, money and soul are set up in tension with each other many times. And so here we have the Samaritan willing to give the things that are normally very precious for people readily, multiple times out, right? You see that? What if you're not rich, like half of you, because you're students, right? Okay. What do we get wrapped up in that is kind of really, 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 really important to us if we don't have money?
Work,
okay. All right, that's good. Ben, what else?
To desire and pursue money.
Desire and prestige?
No, pursuit of the money.
Oh, pursuit of the money. Yes, okay, very good, yes.
Time?
Sure, time. Okay. And so these things are tells, right? And how did this guy view his time? He was going somewhere, right? He had a destination. Mm-hmm. Something happened in his life.
Yes.
How much time did this take away from for him? At least the whole day?
Mm-hmm.
And then he's coming back?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. How did the Samaritan put his strength into this, his volition, his will into this story? What did he do? He did something. How does this involve his energy? Yes. Right.
But really, for his astronomical career, quite a strange thing to do, someone you've never met before. I mean, this guy's in a dirty state and everything.
Right, yes.
So, I mean, we don't know how far the inn was. The fact that he put him on the donkey and then he walked the rest of the journey, whereas maybe he was riding on the donkey initially, but he walked alongside it.
So maybe he picked him up and carried him, then put him on the donkey?
Yeah.
Okay, the guy might not have even smelled pretty good. Okay, have you ever helped somebody that's really needy and then in doing so you find out, oh my goodness, this person may not have had a shower in a long time. And it does something to you. We make a lot of assumptions, you know. And then you go, wow, what am I into here? How did I get into this? And you soul search. Have you ever found yourself in a situation like that? Raise your hand if you found yourself in a situation like that. Okay. Good. I'm glad because we're Christians here. Oh, amen. Okay. Good. It takes our energies. It takes our patience. It takes our, pulling ourselves together and helping somebody in a very difficult time. I'll read you some more quotes here. Clement. When we hear your faith has saved you, we do not understand Christ to be saying absolutely that those who have believed in any way whatsoever are saved unless good actions follow. No one can be a believer and at that same time be immoral. Ignatius, bring on the fire and the cross. Bring on the pack of wild beasts. Let there be the breaking and dislocating of my bones and the severing of my limbs. By the way, this happened to him. Bring on the mutilation of my whole body. In fact, bring on the diabolical forces of Satan. Only let me attain to Christ Jesus. I would rather die for Jesus Christ than to reign over the ends of the entire earth. This is the Bishop of Antioch, who died around 107 AD and was escorted from Antioch all the way to Rome. And he wrote about 6 letters, and this is his attitude: I want to die. And most of the time we're thinking, how can I live? How can I get the latest new iPod? Have you seen it? That new Nano is kind of cute, isn't it? Okay, you know, that's how we think. You know, like, how can I do that on a student budget? You know, maybe I can tell my parents the next thing that I want, my show I want to watch. You know, maybe I can watch it on, I don't know what you call your boxes, your Hulu or your Amazon Prime or whatever. We think so much, how can I feed myself, make myself happy, get that late? Oh, that CD's good. I want to get that CD. Do you hear that tune? Okay, that's 17 pounds. How can I afford that? You know, that's, and we have to every once in a while say, stop! what am I here for? Mm-hmm. What am I about? Am I that priest? Mm-hmm. I just saw that guy that looks like he could use a conversation. And so anyway, okay, love the Lord your God with your minds. How did the Samaritan engage his mind in this ordeal? Yes?
Kind of just thinking about what Sandy was showing about the salting, but just actually he really thought out what the guy needed and actually planned what he needed to do.
Okay.
He even planned extra provisions. You know, he said to the guy, okay, here's 2 silver coins. If there's any extra expenditure, I'll reimburse you for that when I come back.
Right. Okay. Very good. Yes. Yeah.
I think even how he didn't assume that that could have been like a robber or something, he was beaten up. He didn't assume anything. He just saw the need and acted on that.
Right. Okay. Yes. For sure.
He had the expectation for himself to take care of him and stay with him overnight, but he also had the expectation for the innkeeper to also take care of him.
Right. Yeah, that's true. He was being thoughtful of what he was doing in that situation. Yes?
I think there's obviously a lot of planning involved in this and a lot of ability to adapt and change what he was doing. The fact that he even had, I don't know how common it was to carry bandages and maybe provisions were generally made for a long journey and stuff, but the fact that he changed his plans, again, planned to come back to return. Sometimes people think, well, I can be lazy and
yeah.
Finding how I'm going to change it if I'm one away from my way for something.
Sure. Yep. Now, if you were going to help somebody become a Christian, how much thinking, loving with your mind, is involved? What are the kind of things that we have to help a person think through in order to become a Christian in such a way that they're going to last? Okay. Okay, have to think about the consequences. Help that person. Help them think through it and also think through it yourself for them. Okay, what else? Yes?
Discipleship,
okay.
I think when, like if I'm talking to someone, I want them to think the way that a disciple would think. I think counting the cost, really understanding.
Okay.
And really thinking deep about it. What it really means to faith and deeds. You know,
right.
Like what you were saying just now. To live out your life.
Right, very, very good. So, yes?
Personal issues, like their personal situation in their lives.
Okay.
You know, especially with someone maybe who comes from a religious background.
Okay.
There's going to be a lot of baggage with parents who they've always viewed as Christians who aren't Christians. Okay. That's going to be a real, real challenge for them
sure.
to see that.
Sure. Absolutely, yes.
It's important that you live it out as well.
Okay, sure. You don't want to send any mixed signals, okay? Yes.
Have it clear with yourself and then like what the main driver is them to do it, so it's not people like their parents want them to do it, it's because they can help them.
Okay, so helping them sort through their motivations. Okay, yes.
I was going to say I'll talk about like let them see where you came from, like don't forget where you were when you were like physically trying to help them see like you were once in that position and helping them to understand like I don't know the process and everything, but like if you can't relate to them, try to find somebody who might have had the experience and try to like, talk to them about
situations. It's true. There's a lot of planning that goes in to help somebody succeed, right? Mm-hmm. Help bringing somebody in to help them that can identify and relate with some of those kind of challenges. What else? Yes?
Just loving them and being a friend and spending time with them. And sort of like just sometimes you can get on teaching them this and teaching them that, but spending actual time with them.
Right, yep, okay. Fun.
Help them know themselves and their weaknesses, so that they know the things that might cause them to stumble away.
Okay. Yes?
Help them know that if you do it right, then persecution is pretty much guaranteed.
Okay, sure it is, right. Yes?
It both ends what Nadine said, being creative, because I actually think about how can I spend more time with how can I be more of a friend.
Yes, Amanda?
Sometimes it requires quite a lot of head work if somebody who doesn't come from your own background, maybe religiously, and you actually have to understand sometimes their other doctrines and things like that.
Yeah.
It would be so much easier to say, no, let me just go to somebody who's got my background. I don't
right.
have to do that. Mm-hmm.
Right. I was a young Christian in DeKalb, Illinois, 1982, probably about a year old as a Christian, and somebody said, why don't we have a dorm Bible study? Could you lead the discussion? So I went over to this dorm, and he says, I can get a few of these people here. And he said, we can get a lot more if you say you're going to teach on the book of Revelation. Okay, I'll tell you right now, I knew nothing about the book of Revelation. And I can't even believe that I took on the challenge, but I gave myself about a couple of hours to prepare, because then he went around to the whole dorm and said, we're going to have somebody teach on the book of Revelation. We had so many people. We had 17 visitors. I had to speak from a bed, on a double bed from up above, down to people, you know. And so I'll never forget, it had a huge impact on me. Because not only did I realize I didn't know what I was talking about, okay, that from that point on, I began to be a person who was going to find out the answers to questions that nobody else did. So I wanted to know where the idea of praying Jesus into your heart came from. I wanted to know when the Catholic Church started, when the Protestant, when each movement started, where the speaking in tongues, what that was all about. And so, and for me, loving God with my mind is my instinct now. It came, I was an engineer, so it was much more instinctive. But I do love God with my mind. But I want to ask you, which of these is the hardest one for you? Because loving God with my mind is not hard for me. Compared to the others, it's not, okay? So which one is the hardest for you, and state why, okay? And then we'll be closed here. What is the hardest for you, and why? Yes?
I think engaging my heart is the hardest for me.
Okay.
Because I'm quite logical, and I have a science background, so it's really easy for me to think of the logical things, and also to love God with my mind, but actually when it comes to the heart, that's where I struggle a lot more.
Sure.
And it gets hidden because I do love God with my mind. Sometimes I don't quite see how I'm not loving God with my heart because my mind is so engaged.
Sure. Okay. Yes. Thank you. I would echo you for me too. That's kind of where I would find it as well. Okay. Who? Yes.
Strength.
Okay. And why?
Because I will fall into being lazy.
Okay.
It's all in the mind and in the heart and the words. To do the practical things, to show your love through deeds.
Yep.
If that was the question.
That's the right answer. I mean, yeah, you answered it really well. Thank you. Who else? Yes, in the far back, yes.
I think for me, mine, because I think I'm quite a hearty person. Like, I can just be really, like, just do what I feel like. And I think when you don't think kind of rationally, or even reason in kind of what God says in the scriptures, and think, oh, like, what is actually the best situation, and how can I help different people differently? I think I find hard to think about, because I just what I naturally think will encourage me, so it must encourage them as well.
Okay, great, thank you. And one more. Yes.
I think for me, mind is as well also, because I'm quite used to doing stuff. I'm quite used to generally serving or going here or doing that. But actually really thinking about how much time I consciously spend in the Bible, how much am I learning, how much am I growing, what kind of books am I reading.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm very consistent with reading books. I pick one up, I stop. I pick one up, I stop. You know, and just how am I increasing my knowledge and how am I sharing that with others.
Okay, thank you. Here's my challenge, is that one of these you know you're good at. Lead other people with it. Show other people to have it. Just be bold about it. This is something that's more natural for you spiritually. You feel more connected to God with it. You feel like God has given you something with it. Lead other people with it that's not their strength. Assert yourself. Go ahead and just, you know, be positive. Be an encouragement in that area. And the one that you're not so good at, ask somebody who you know that is their strength. And when you have those, like, I don't know what to do with my life, or I don't know what to, you know, when there's a tension here, ask somebody. Have people in your life. Should I miss this thing to do this, or should I miss that to do this, whether it's church or evangelism or the poor or whatever? Hey, I want to be like the Good Samaritan, but sometimes I just don't know how. And that's where we find out in the areas that are our blind spots. We latch on to those who are really good at something that we're not. and then we help them align us, calibrate us. And anyway, I just want to say thank you for allowing Trisha and I to be part of your midweek tonight. It's great to see you all. Thank you.